La prison de Bordeaux et de la prison Rivière-des-Prairies en composant le numéro 514-876-3748. Encore une fois, c'est 514-876-3748 pour les appels collectes. On a aussi un numéro normal qui est 438-337-8423. N'hésitez pas à appeler ce numéro et à nous laisser un message avec des nouvelles à partager sur l'émission ou un message audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur.
Good evening and welcome to AMANLA, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you here at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. We're still in the midst of the holidays and Doug and I are taking it a little bit easy over last week and now this week as well. So Doug, I know that you have plucked something produced by somebody else for us to listen to on AMANLA tonight. Tell us more.
Well, yes, and it's been fun to look things up and to get exposed to it. But listeners may remember that we covered A Continent for the Taking, what the heck was the name of the rest of that title? The Tragedy and Hope of Africa by Howard W. French. That was in the early 2000s, I believe, yeah. Right after the Rwandan debacle. And Howard W. French has written a new book called Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. And it's an impressive book that we first covered, actually, when it was published in 2021. But since then, I've acquired a copy and finally sat down to work my way through it. It is a problem of my lifestyle that it takes me so long to get through a book, but I'm glad that I stuck with this one. It's a good one. Now that I'm finished reading it, I'm even more excited to recommend it as an essential read for anyone who wants to understand why Africa and its history has been so skewed in the telling of Western civilization courses. Howard French calls it erasure because it's been a long-standing self-centered myth of colonial powers about the development of Europe from feudalism through the mercantilism to full-blown capitalism, entirely through the industry, hard work, ingenuity, and of course, racial superiority of Europeans. It relates the role of Africa played in the rise of capitalism is completely erased from the dominant narrative. Worse still, the impact of the European slave economy and colonialism is recounted completely as a blame the victim thing when it relates to poverty and underdevelopment. I won't try to recount the complete contents of this book, except to say that it is well-written, provides a very clear, factually based, but easily read data for readers to catch on to. In the clip I have for you tonight, the Center for Brooklyn History joined Howard French to talk about his important book with Sean Jacobs, the founder and editor of the website Africa is a Country. This program was offered in connection with the Center for Brooklyn History's major public history initiative, Brooklyn Resists. The discussion was recorded in October 2021, shortly after the book appeared in print. We are regular users of Africa is a Country's excellent website, whose name alone challenges the myths of African erasure. Stay tuned for this interview.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's program, a discussion of Howard French's new book, Born in Blackness, subtitled Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. I'm Marcia Eli from the Brooklyn Public Library's Center for Brooklyn History and the library's Arts and Culture team, BPL Presents. Tonight, I am thrilled to welcome Howard and his conversation partner, Sean Jacobs, to talk about this important and deeply researched book. It counters the Eurocentric history that we have all been served and opens up new perspectives and historical narratives. As Nigel Cliff says in his recent New York Times piece, it is a history of modernity that puts Africa at center stage. So now let me say a word about each of our guests and hand it off to them. Howard W. French is a professor of journalism at Columbia University and former New York Times bureau chief in the Caribbean and Central America, West and Central Africa, Tokyo, and Shanghai, the author of 5 books. He lives in New York City. And Sean Jacobs is associate professor of international affairs at the New School and founder and editor of Africa is a Country, a website of criticism, analysis, and new writing. He was born and grew up in Cape Town, South Africa. Howard, Sean, it's such an honor to have you both here. Thank you so much. I hand it over to you.
Thank you very much, Marcia, and to the Brooklyn Public Library, and welcome, Howard. It's a great pleasure for me to chat with you about your new book, Born into Blackness. And I'm hoping that you are going to do most of the talking, as after all, we're here celebrating your book and people have come to hear you. And I know we don't have a lot of time. And so later, I would love to hear from the audience who also have questions for you about the book and the ideas in the book. So I'm just going to dive in. And as I said, I'm hoping that you will talk. So first, congratulations on the book, which for me, I think of it as a big revisionist history of modernity and Africans' place at the heart of that historical period, which we are still living, as well as can be described as a way of seeing the world. And I'll get to that later. But crucially for me also, your book amounts to a piece of decolonial scholarship and journalism. So well done. I'm really impressed in reading it. But I want to start with a very straightforward question. I want to ask about your primary motivation for writing this book. So why and how did you, why did you do this project? What are the personal and scholarly motivations, I suppose, and including as a person of African descent, that compelled you to write this book?
Thank you very much, Sean, for engaging with me this way. Sean, the audience doesn't know this, but Sean and I have known each other mostly from a distance, but sometimes face-to-face for a number of years. And I'm also an admirer of your work, especially via this ironically titled website called Africa is a Country. And it's important that I signal that it's ironic because some people don't get that up front all the time. You know, at the end of your question came the kind of nugget of the answer. And you said as a person of African-American descent. So that's true. Some people are confused by that. I'm particularly light-skinned African-American, but both of my parents were African-Americans. And I grew up with a kind of deep awareness of my history as an African-American and no confusion about my identity as an African-American. By way of first education in the household and in schools, fortunately, and then later by profession, I was kind of thrown into the world of my book. I became, right after I left college, I moved to West Africa, which was totally new for me at that time, and I was plunged into a kind of moment of extraordinary discovery in terms of just, you know, you could be a very well-educated American, especially at the time when I graduated from college, and you could be considered a well-educated American and still know nothing about Africa. And so here I was being confronted by this very rich reality that I had, you know, really little suspicion of prior to the beginning of those experiences. After that, I become sort of by accidental a set of life choices, I become a journalist and I start writing about Africa in this early period. That's where I became a journalist. And then I was later hired by the New York Times and sent around the Atlantic Rim to various places. I began as a correspondent for the New York Times in the early 90s in the Caribbean Basin and in Central America and the northern tier of South America. And then later I was sent, and this is also a phrase I employ with some irony because it can be used with hostile intent. I was sent back to Africa by the New York Times as a correspondent, having been a freelancer there for other newspapers previously. And then, you know, I speak European languages, not just English, but others. I'm American, so there's already 3/4 of the leg of the, if you will, of the Atlantic world. And the European languages and a lot of exposure to Europe along the way sort of gave me the fourth leg. And so I was kind of bathing in this reality. And it just took me I was asking myself questions all along the way, and the questions became more urgent and more deeply informed as I proceeded through life. And they finally reached the point where, the critical mass just wouldn't allow me to ignore them. And I think the moment when that happened actually was in another part of the world altogether. I spent a decade, a little more than a decade, in East Asia working as a journalist, first in Japan and then in China. And I've written a lot about those parts of the world, but there was this pregnant question always in the air in that part of the world about how it is that the West had become predominant, and what was this all about, and what were the factors that led into it, and how much of it was likely to be lasting or not, right? And so this all kind of re-energized these earlier questions that I had circulating in my system previously about how did the Atlantic world come about, and how is it that the West became powerful? I had been wondering those questions. And so when I finished my last China-related book, I said, this is the time. I've been thinking about this for more than two decades. I've been reading about it in a kind of on and off way for a decade. And let me do this now before it's too late. I want to define a term that I expect might come into the discussions into our conversation, and that I just employed the West, I think. And the West is one of these contested terms that sometimes is employed very abusively and is never employed without problems, right? When I use the West in the context of this book, I mean something very specific. And when I say Africa and Africans created the modern world, I also mean something very specific. The most important product that Africa and Africans created of all, we can talk about the various things that went into it, but the biggest product they created was the West. What do I mean by that? Let me define the West first. The West, as I'm conceiving of it, is the condominium that exists between Western European countries and North American countries, especially Anglophone North America, and most especially the United States. And it is my contention that without Africa and Africans, that condominium would never have come about, that there could not have been a West, and that it was by virtue of African wealth in the first instance. I talk about how this all really begins not with slaves, but with gold. But then subsequently, after about a century of the adventure driven by gold, it becomes a slave story. And slaves and agricultural production are what made the West possible. And so we can also talk about what modernity means, and there are other ramifications for that. But this is my principal claim in the book, that Africa and Africans made the West possible.
So just as a follow-up, that was a great answer. Just as a follow-up, one of the things I think, and as you point out, that we've known each other and sort of in passing and we've met, one of the things that I've always liked and admired about you as someone familiar with your writing and your reporting about Africa in particular, is how you break with consensus. Like, and I kind of reminded you of, you know, your first book, A Continent for the Taking, which came out in 2004, I think, about in which you write about kind of the after effects of colonialism and sort of contemporary African politics. And in particular in that book, like the way you wrote about what happened in Rwanda after 94 and how that's connected to the DRC. I think that's how we first kind of started talking. Mm-hmm. So what I'm just noticing in terms of this, like before we get to specifics, in terms of like kind of your broader take on the world, if you want, is then subsequent to that, you also write two other books about China and China's place in the world, China's relations with Africa, and the last book that you write before this one is China's sort of attempt to become this kind of global power. Is there something about how this book is there a conversation between these books? I mean, maybe I'm sort of mischaracterizing those books even. Is there something that you're trying to do with all this work, if you want to, like, you know, when you put it together or when you sort of started out, did you plan it or it just kind of fell into place?
So I love the question because partly it's quite unexpected, but partly also because it's rich in terms of the possibilities of, you know, it provides me for an answer. I would be lying to you if I set out 2004, my first book comes out, if I said to you I had some grand design or I had some big picture or I had a list of books that I knew, even sketchy list of books that I knew that I was going to write. I didn't have that. The first book proved to me that I could write a book and that I liked writing books. And so that puts you a little bit further down the road. And so each book did something like that to me. This question about, are the books in conversation in any way? My last book, for the audience, which may not know, is about Chinese history and the relationship between Chinese history and China's contemporary ambitions. The title of that book is Everything Under the Heavens, which is an ancient Chinese expression about power and legitimacy. And in that book, I become, I enter into the mode of the historian much more, far more, dramatically more than anything I had ever undertaken before. And much less the journalist, much more the historian. And I'm very conscious that I'm not a trained historian. I'm not a scholarly, a historical scholar in the kind of normally academically credentialed way, right? And so this was like, with what I said about the first book, I had to prove to myself that I could write a book and understand that I enjoyed writing a book before I could get any further, right? And so that happened with the first book. In this last immediate prior book, I proved to myself the same things, that I can write a history-minded book and that I enjoyed writing a history-minded book. And so a lot of the inhibitions that might otherwise have affected me about taking on, you know, a story about the creation of the West or 600 years of history or some other big question began to fall away. I don't mean to say that I didn't have challenges. I don't want to mean to say I didn't have doubts. This was a beast of a project for me in terms of research. And hopefully, you know, you can't actually see all of that in from sentence to sentence, because I don't want it to be too much of a labor for the reader. But this was an immense beast. But I didn't go into it with a feeling like, oh, is it okay for me to write about history? Is it okay for me to ask big questions, right? By that point, the last book had answered that question for me. And so I take that a lot further even than the last book went. I did so perfectly aware, perfectly prepared, as with the China book that I mentioned, for historians to take exception with various things. I love that conversation. I don't think there's anything such thing as the last word in any kind of historical book, right? And so I didn't write, you know, I think that I've done my work, my research very diligently. I think I've documented things in a pretty complete way, but I offer no claim that this is the last word or this is the most definitive account ever that you'll read of any aspect of this. That's not the case, right?
Right.
There you have the answer about the relationship.
Right. So let me just get, I want to get to some of the specifics of the book and kind of the comment I made at the start where I said it's very much a revisionist history. So one of there's a lot of specifics in there that some of the readers, some of them it may be news, but I think to a lot of people, it is quite novel in the way that you kind of take on, you know, a collective past. And I really loved how you opened the book with the story of Mansa Musa, the 14th century emperor of the Mali Empire in West Africa. And I have to add here, for people who don't know what Mali meant then, it was like a very large territory south of the Sahara, stretching to the Atlantic coast. And it included Senegal, southern Mauritania, Mali, parts of Burkina Faso, Niger, the Gambia. I mean, just it was a very large area. And the part of the history that's relevant, like here, and in the book you write about this, is that in 1324, Mansa Musa goes on a pilgrimage to Mecca with a very large party. He takes 80,000, people, a mix of soldiers, diplomats, and also slaves. And also he takes a lot of gold with him to smooth his passage. And the one spot that he stops in is Cairo, which is quite memorable because there he gives like hundreds of pounds of gold to like the sultan, to a sultan or the sultan of Cairo. And the thing that you then show is like how the news of this gift like spreads to Europe. And this is also, I suppose, because, you know, on Twitter these days, everybody comes out about Mansa Musa being the richest person, the richest king in the history of the world. And I think that's where that comes from. But it's also that the news of that trip serves for you as a catalyst for how you get us to the so-called age of discovery. And then you use that, which I think is where the revisionism comes in, to tell the story. Can you like maybe, because I sort of bastardized it, but can you say more about like just deciding to use that as a setup and the power of that story to then take that allows us to talk about Portugal in a different way, about, you know, the Portuguese age of discovery? Yeah.
Sure. You didn't bastardize it, but let me take it a little bit further and to add a few brushstrokes to the picture you've painted. I had a conversation recently with the well-known filmmaker Raoul Peck, in which he told me about some of his philosophy of storytelling. And he talked about how he wanted to make viewers of his film sit up and pay attention about the so-called Middle Passage and its brutality. And he struggled with how best to achieve this. And he said what he did in the end was show a slave ship full of white people who were slaves being whipped in the galley of a slave ship, getting them across the ocean to work in a plantation, and how he, in his view, this had worked very well because ever since that scene was created, white people have approached him to speak movingly about how much that had affected them. Like, could you imagine the inhumanity of this sort of thing? It took seeing white people in that predicament to actually make this fairly well-known idea that there had been a Middle Passage come home to them, right? And so this relates in a way to what I'm trying to do in the beginning of the book, right? I mean, so some of the most prevailing notions about Africa in kind of public awareness go like this. One is that Africa has no history. There are famous philosophers and thinkers over the ages in Europe who have said variations of that very phrase, right? Hegel being one of them most famously. Africa has no history, and Africa is sort of, has always been kind of a cut off from the rest of the world, right? And so I start out with the book saying that actually this part of West Africa where the Mali Empire was had big cities at an early phase in human history, where there were not big cities in many places yet. And in some of those big cities were Chinese trade goods that dated to the Han Dynasty, which means between the year 200 BC and the year 200 AD. And this proves, like, we don't necessarily have to conclude that Malians went to China or that Chinese came to Mali, but that there was an active chain of trade linking Mali to the big broad world all the way back then, right? That's the first big piece to sort of exploding the conventional picture that we have of the history of this part of the world. The second piece is the voyage of Mansa Musa, but I actually want to sort of set that voyage up with another idea which is expressed in the book, which I'm sure you read, but you didn't mention, and that is Mansa Musa's predecessor. Mm-hmm. Mansa Musa's predecessor was a ruler named Abu Bakr II. And Abu Bakr II, the story goes, had an obsession in the 1420s with getting to the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Now, so what does that actually mean? That means that there was a guy in West Africa, in the Sudan or Sahel region of West Africa, who was a ruler of a powerful kingdom, who already had a concept that there was something on the other side of the ocean. Most Europeans did not have that concept at that time. Europeans mostly thought that the world had an edge to it, and if you went too far, you would fall off the edge, right? So this is an important story, not only because it proves that, Mali is connected to other places, but that Africans not only have history, but Africans have a history of ambition. And Africans have a history of thinking globally and thinking in terms of great schemes and, you know, enterprising bids to do this, that, and the other, right? And so this is an enormous thing, right? And the story goes, and I'm saying the story goes because We only know this by virtue of what the rich person you spoke to, the rich ruler Mansa Musa, told the governor of Cairo when he arrived in Cairo with all the gold. So there, you imagine the two of them, the Malian ruler and the governor of Cairo, are sitting in a reception room, and the governor of Cairo has a scribe who's taking notes about the meeting. There are contemporaneous notes of the meeting which say that Mansa Musa said, my predecessor had this vision of going to the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. He probably didn't use the word Atlantic Ocean, but that the Great Sea, to find out what is on the other side, right? This is for me the equivalent of the white people in the slave ship being whipped. It's like, okay, if you can hear that story and not have your sense of what Africa is and what Africa has been exploded, there's something switched off about you, right? And so Mansa Musa now arrives in Cairo. And the way I tell this story is Mansa Musa is actually, so Abu Bakr didn't, if these voyages, there were two of them, according to the Cairo account, if these voyages happened, there's no reason to believe they succeeded. In fact, Abu Bakr, Mansa Musa's predecessor, is believed to have, according to the story, died. He went aboard the ships in the second of these journeys, right? And was lost at sea, right? The most interesting thing about this to me is that I interpret the Mansa Musa voyage to Cairo and Mecca with all the gold, not as a refutation of what Abu Bakr was trying to do, but a trying to do what Abu Bakr was doing by other means, saying, okay, enlarging our place in the world didn't work by sea. We didn't find more, like Mali had more gold than any other place in the known world then. We didn't find new markets for gold by going out by sea. We didn't find ways around the North African political entities that are blocking our access to trade with Europe by going out to sea. Let me see if I can do this by going to Cairo and gaining recognition through the Mamluk Empire and getting them to accept me or us as a major force in the Islamic world. And by virtue of that, sort of get a seat at the first table in terms of world history, right? This to me is just, you know, I felt that I needed to sort of, because actually every part of my book is overturning the weak and shallow conventional wisdom about African history and about Africa's place in world history. And as I said a few minutes ago, Africa's central role in the creation of the West, I thought I had to begin with the equivalent of white people being beaten on the slave ship. Right. Right? So you guys think Africans are primitive and that they have no history. How about this, okay? Almost a century before Columbus, Africans were thinking about the other side of the Atlantic and trying to figure out how to get there.
Which gets to me to the, like, I don't, it's not necessarily the next step in the story, but then what you do is, because I just sort of mentioned like the role then of Portugal. Like the way you tell them the story of Portugal is like not this kind of impatient Portugal that is then trying to go around the Cape and trying to figure out a way to get to the east, but the Portugal who sort of gets stuck in on that part of the coast. And maybe if you could say a little bit about that. And at the same time, the story you tell is in the way in which Portugal gets transformed, in which Europe gets transformed. Can you say a little bit about that? Because that's also something that is, that is, as I said, novel. And for a lot of people, that's new information. Mm-hmm.
So the traditional narrative about how we arrive at this thing that I'm calling the modern age is that it begins with exploration that is driven by people from Iberia, meaning Spain and Portugal, right? And most people say correctly that Portuguese were actually the pioneers, right? Where this narrative goes completely kind of astray is by saying that this was really all about finding a maritime route to Asia. There are lots of reasons on the face of it why this doesn't hold up, but we meaning the Western world, have such an indisposition toward Africa that it's the natural thing is to cut Africa out of stories, out of big stories, stories that we attach meaning, grand meaning to. The most normal thing is to say Africa is not really part of that, right? And so this age of exploration comes to be described as finding a way to India or to the Indies or to the East. And nobody bothers to stop and say, actually, you know, there had been roads to the East, terrestrial roads to the East since the Romans. Why do they need, what's this about? Like discover, is it logical? Like this was the passion of the age of exploration. I have to find, like, is there really China over there or something? This had been known for centuries. I think I document I said I don't pretend to give the definitive account of anything, even though I believe in my research. I do think that it is pretty incontrovertible that Prince Henry the Navigator, the sort of grand patriarch of the age of exploration, was obsessed with finding African gold. And this obsession with finding African gold is kicked off by the circulation in Europe in the 1370s of a map called the Catalan Atlas. And the Catalan Atlas is actually depicted on the cover of my book and shows, it reproduces the event of Mansa Musa arriving, not arriving in Cairo, but it reproduces Mansa Musa showing him in an African environment, sitting on a golden throne, holding a big solid golden orb and holding a golden staff in the other hand. And this sort of gives flesh to the notion that there's got to be this immense wealth, which Europeans had already heard about because of the legend of the Cairo trip, which depressed gold prices throughout the Mediterranean world for more than a decade, right? And so Prince Henry the Navigator, he's not looking for the East. He's looking for African gold, and he dies before Portugal finds the gold. But in 1471, the Portuguese arrive in the place we now call Ghana, and they discover there that actually commoners, the most ordinary people, are walking around with abundant golden jewelry on themselves. And the Portuguese, like, as you would expect, figure no commoners in Europe are walking around with gold on them. This must be the mother lode. It's got to be nearby. And so they set themselves up there. And I'm going very quickly here. I walk through this story at a deliberate pace in the book, but they build a fort there and they establish political relations locally with the peoples of that area. They didn't try to conquer them. And they're trading in gold very successfully. Well, this gold does extraordinary things in Europe, to come finally to the point of your question. Portugal had been, it was, first of all, a very new country. Portugal had just been created a little more than a century before all this happens, with the birth of the Aviz dynasty and the breaking away from Spain. And Portugal it was a very rural society that had almost no urbanization and almost no economic life beyond subsistence. So the only trade goods of any note that the Portuguese had back then were cork, used for, you know, in making of things like wine bottles, and dried fish. Portugal was an exceedingly poor place. And so the Portuguese show up in what we now call Ghana. They discover all of this gold. They also figure out they don't have the military power to conquer the Ghanaian peoples. But they don't also have the trade goods that the Ghanaians, I'm calling them Ghanaians, they were not known as Ghanaians back then, but they don't have the trade goods that the Ghanaians, that will motivate the Ghanaians to trade much with them. The peoples of the West African coast had thought of themselves as being pretty self-sufficient in most regards. They had lots of exquisite cloth and various other items. And so the Portuguese had to go back to Europe with some of the gold that they managed to get in, to come into possession of, and establish trade circuits within Europe, mostly to Germany and the Low Countries, where they were obtaining fancier cloth than the Portuguese possessed, but especially metal goods, things like brass bassinets or ingots and things like that. And they found that the people in this gold trading area of West Africa prized these metal goods because they could bang them and work them into various things that they needed. And those sorts of metals were in short supply in that particular area. So this becomes the basis of the Portuguese gold trade, but with what I'm calling Ghana, but it also becomes the basis of these extraordinary productive circuits of trade within Europe that begin to integrate European economies in a way that they had not previously been integrated, creating long-term trade connections between Southern Europe and Northern Europe that become quite important. And also, finally, because Portugal was coming into, you know, the explosion of wealth in Portugal was such that it drove, and this is another aspect of what it, the modernity that is mentioned in the title of the book, this drove urbanization in Portugal at a rhythm that Portugal had never seen before, that Spain had never seen before. And urbanization meant breaking away from traditional ways of life and a kind of new kind of cosmopolitan awareness that, you know, you're in an interconnected world and that there's constantly new things arriving from faraway places and things to be discovered, right? This is psychologically speaking a giant moment, and it happened in the first instance because of the quote unquote discovery of gold in so-called Ghana.
You're listening to Amanda here on CQT 90.3 FM.
I wanted to, that's a great answer. I wanted to get, because I know we don't have much time and I have some other more general questions I want to ask, but I just want to quickly, if you could, because I know somebody in the chat sort of raised the question of like what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic. So, and just one other quick note as we move on, one of the things that I perked up because I studied that, you know, the relationship between media and politics for a long time. So I perked up when you kind of talked about the emergence of the modern public sphere and you kind of connected this also to this, you know, kind of the history of slavery and the traffic of people. You know, sugar and how it transformed, like how it changed people's leisure, the way people live. But I wanted to get to this other part of the story, which is the story then moves kind of off the coast of Africa into these islands in the Atlantic, São Tomé, and then it kind of goes across the ocean to Brazil, particularly to the Caribbean, Barbados, Jamaica, you know, Haiti. And then I suppose, and finally, if I'm kind of like simplifying it, it moves to the U.S. And what I liked about that part of the story, which again, these are things that people talk about and say, scholars talk about them, but it's nice to see that popularized in the way you did, which is you kind of get this, the Caribbean is like really important. I think there's a phrase you use, which I've forgotten now, about the role of the Caribbean, like in the North Atlantic.
It's the boiler room.
The boiler room is, I remember the phrase you use. And can you just talk a little bit about that story and like how we get to the U.S. Like, and also like the way that you write about Haiti. And I noticed that you in the acknowledgments, you mentioned Lauren Du Bois and some of his work. So if you can tell that story, like then how Haiti is also related to the U.S. I mean, I know it's a big story, but I really enjoyed how you put Barbados, put Jamaica, put Haiti kind of in the front. And I'm not necessarily saying displacing the U.S. or decentering the U.S. is maybe what that kind of achieved there.
Well, okay, I'll take it in the order that you asked.
Yeah.
You asked a lot.
I said a lot, yeah.
These are big questions and they're
important. I know, yeah.
And I almost feel sheepish, you know, sometimes because, first of all, this is physically a pretty big book.
It is, yeah.
It's covering a lot of territory. Both geographically and across time. So it's six centuries, basically. And I'm going to try to do as quickly as I can what I can to sort of respond to your question or questions. So sugar, the plant, comes from somewhere in Asia. Some people think New Guinea, some people think Indonesia a long time ago. And, you know, I'm not a historian of sugar and I don't recount all of this, but it makes a very slow circuit to the west, to the west until it gets to the Muslim world, Persia and the Arab world, probably sometime in the 4th, 5th, 6th centuries. And then it gets down, the Sicilians begin to grow it in Sicily. And so for Western Europe, until I pick up with the growth of sugar in various African environments, sugar was a luxury thing. There was no refined sugar available to any ordinary people in Europe. And the people who had access to sugar paid like you would pay for gold to have sugar. So So because it was so valuable, there was a value attached to figuring out how to produce it. And you couldn't produce it in a non, you couldn't produce it well in a non-tropical environment. And so the Europeans are trying to grow it in places like Madeira, which is, you know, in somewhat North Atlantic, right? And that's not really the ideal environment for it. But as Henry the Navigator's people are working their way down the continent, first they discover gold in Ghana, and then a number of other really important things happen. A couple of years later, they discover a very sophisticated kingdom in the place that we now call Congo, and which was then also called Congo, but which we now spell with a K. And I go into this, the history of this kingdom is extraordinarily fascinating and important to my story, but I'm not going to get into that with this answer. But as they are engaging with, as they're exploring that part of Central Africa, they discover an uninhabited island called Sao Tome, which is off the coast of sort of in the, if you will, in the armpit of Africa, off the coast. And they, somebody had cuttings from sugar plants aboard their ship, and they plant the sugar in Sao Tome, and in that tropical equatorial, in fact, environment, sugar grows like they had never seen it grow before. And so the Portuguese have discovered that, oh, this is an ideal place to grow sugar. The only thing that they're lacking is the manpower to do it with. And what we have seen with sugar as a crop throughout history is that nobody will voluntarily work to grow sugar. Sugar doesn't get grown as a as an agricultural crop anywhere willingly, because it is so brutal and so painstaking an effort involving so many difficult steps and so much hardship and so much physical danger, right? And so the Portuguese begin acquiring slaves along the African coast from between Benin, which is now in present-day Nigeria, all the way to Congo, which is in Central Africa, and growing sugar in Sao Tome. And I'm fast-forwarding through lots and lots of details, which are kind of broken out in the book. But there's this period between the 1530s and the 1570s when sugar is just like it's an economic miracle around sugar for Portugal is taking place in Sao Tome. And then at the end of that century, the Portuguese had discovered at the beginning of the 16th century Brazil, but they spent the first decades in Brazil not being able to figure out from their perspective what Brazil was good for. And Brazil seemed useless. There was no gold there that they had been able to discover yet. There were no obvious great agricultural products there. And then somebody got the idea, if we can grow sugar at such profit in Sao Tome, let's try it in Brazil. And so Brazil turns out to be just as good as Sao Tome, just in terms of the ecosystem. But in terms of the territory, it's endless, right? Brazil's immense. And so sugar makes the leap to Brazil. The real takeoff is probably around the year 1570. Sugar goes through this extraordinary ascension in terms of the value that Portugal was extracting from its colony via sugar cultivation at immense human cost. First, the dying off or killing of large numbers of native peoples, and then the importation of enslaved people from Africa to work on these plantations with the same amount of with similar kinds of mortalities. There's all these geopolitical things that frame these events taking place at this time. One important one is that Spain and Portugal fused their crowns. Portugal was absorbed by Spain, basically, and they became a kind of a union of the two countries, right? And Holland, or the Netherlands, was Protestant, was essentially a colony or a subject country of Spain, but was Protestant, and they had begun to rebel against the Spanish and seek their independence. And so the Dutch and the Spanish begin to fight, and the Spanish figure out that the best way to weaken, the Dutch figure out the best way to weaken the Spanish is to attack the vulnerable Portuguese, who have all of these colonies in agricultural colonies in places like Brazil, where they're extracting enormous amounts of wealth, right? When I say enormous amounts of wealth, here's what you need to understand. So the famous story we know about Europeans in the New World in this era is that the Spaniards were making enormous killings in gold and silver, especially silver, right? That places like Potosi in Bolivia and in Mexico, the Spanish galleons were shipping enormous amounts of silver out and were selling the silver to China in exchange for tea and silk and various other things, right? Brazil was making more money in sugar for Portugal than Spain was making from its much more famous metals, right? And so the Dutch figure out, okay, if we can, we can't really take on the Spanish directly, we're not strong enough for that, but if we can weaken the Portuguese link, we can break up all that wealth production for this this joined crown between Portugal and Spain. And so the Portuguese begin to attack Brazil and eventually wrest parts of Brazil away from, I'm sorry, the Dutch begin to attack Brazil and eventually wrest parts of Brazil away from the Portuguese. Later in this story, in fact, and I'm not going to go into this, it's in the book, it's incredible. This is like the geopolitics of the Mansa Musa and Abu Bakr era. The Kingdom of Congo proposes, this comes from the African side, proposes an alliance with the Dutch to fight a world war in the South Atlantic between Africans and Europeans, i.e. the Dutch, against the joined crown between Spain and Portugal. And a war is prosecuted that you have never heard about before, that on this basis, which is just astounding, right? Anyway, back to sugar. So with the Dutch and the Portuguese fighting over Brazil, and the Dutch initially being very successful in prizing away parts of Brazil to colonize them on its own and extract wealth in sugar from it for Dutch purposes, the Portuguese eventually take the upper hand and they reclaim their Brazilian colonies, and Dutch people flee and they enter Barbados. Or they sell their skills to English people who have begun to colonize Barbados. And so in the 1630s, sugar begins to be planted on a sort of mass basis in Barbados for the first time by the Brazilians using Portuguese, by the British using Portuguese techniques and African slaves. In fact, one of the accounts I give in the book says that the British actually favored buying slaves from Brazil because those slaves actually had the expertise already in making the sugar. What we see then from the 1630s to the end of the 17th century is an explosion of wealth like Britain, it was England at the time, but that England had never seen before ever in terms of any extraterritorial adventure outside of England in its history. Sugar takes off in Barbados, which I forget what the math worked out to be, but it's something like a quarter the size of Long Island, right? Barbados is making more money for Britain, for England, in this period, in those decades of the 17th century, than Spain had ever made in gold and silver, right? And so another piece, I'm sorry, there's a lot of things to deal with here, but a piece of this history that I find particularly fascinating and particularly unknown goes to your question about the public sphere. So what begins to happen in Europe as a result of all of this? We are very familiar, any intelligent, educated person who has any experience outside of the United States cannot help but be confronted with stories about how the British or how the French or how this or that European power went around the world and transformed the cultures of the various places that they colonized and settled, right? I'm going to tell you a story about how Africans transformed European cultures. So this was not by plan. I'm not pretending that Africans said, hey, we're going to turn the British into Democrats. That's not what happened. But African sweat and blood made British democracy possible. And here's how it happened. Coffee, in the 17th century, sanitation was very poor in Britain, in England, and other parts of Europe. Water was unsafe to drink. The workplace common workplace drink in England in those days was ale. Because you're drinking ale during the workday, you're feeling tired or if not altogether drunk most of the time, and you are consequently not very productive. Well, along comes coffee and sugar, which makes the coffee palatable. And to make the coffee, in the first place, you have to boil water, which makes the water sanitary. And so as a result of what happened and begins to happen in Barbados in the 1630s, first sugar in great quantities, quantity sufficient so that sugar becomes a mass commodity as opposed to a luxury good, sort of suffuses the British diet, the English, I keep saying British, it's still England, the English diet. And then in the 1650s, actually in 1650, the first coffee shop opens up in Oxford and is a commercial success. And because success breeds emulation, coffee shops start popping up all over England, especially in London. And when coffee shops begin to pop up, coffee's the new thing. You're sitting there drinking this hot beverage, which is clean. You're not going to get gastroenteritis from drinking it. And you're probably smoking slave-grown tobacco, which is another stimulant. And instead of being drunk or full of torpor, you're having lively conversations with people. This is the birth of the public sphere in England. And the thing that happens to sort of pull this all together is the result of kind of innovation in terms of entrepreneurship. Some clever characters figured out we have these captive audiences who like to sit around talking about the affairs of the day in coffee shops. What if we were to sell them a sheet on which we printed the updates of the day's news? News wasn't really a term yet, but that's what it became. Like, okay, let's give them updates about the discussions in Parliament. Let's give them updates about what happened with the war in France. Let's give them updates like day by day, week by week. This is the birth of the newspaper. And with the birth of the newspaper, which comes out of the spread of coffee and sugar and tobacco, then you begin to have a total transformation in the understanding among English people of what it actually means to be a citizen. A citizen means I have the right not just to be informed by an independent source about what's happening in the open, in public. Everybody could whisper about what's happening. Now it's in open, it's in public, it's on paper. You know who the publisher was, right? Not only do I have a right to do this, but this is my duty to do this. To be a citizen means to take it as your duty to be informed. This all grows out of this interconnection with Africa that made all of this possible.
I sort of said, like, I gave you like that big sweeping question, because this is the thing about the book. It's like you said, it's a big book. It's, you know, six decades, three continents, plus the, sorry.
Six centuries.
Plus, you know, the three continents, the Caribbean, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot here, and it's very hard to, as I said, to like try to condense it into an hour-long conversation. But I want to ask this, because I think this is an important question. This goes to the question of, and I want people to actually go read the book rather than us going through the whole book, because there's so much there. But one of the things that struck me when I was reading it, I kept thinking, I think you've answered some of this already. Like, what do you want to achieve with this book? Like what are the conversations you want to change with this book? And partly you've sort of answered that, the conversation that you're having with the West, the conversation that, you know, that you would like, for example, a white reader to get out of this. But there's also a way to get out of this book from the Black world, the people of African descent. And I ask this because in the book, you are often shocked when you visit Black majority countries on the continent and in the Caribbean, or cities where there are large populations of people of African descent, Black people, and you see like how little little commemorations there are, like museums. I think at one point you say like it's not even like a real, like, is this a museum or something? There's no plaques, there's no public events. You also find that how very little the people living there know about this history. I mean, is that, so there's those two sides, and you've really broken down, I suppose, the Western side of it. What about this other part?
Thank you for that question, Sean. This is probably the thing that has troubled me the most in writing this book, wrestling with your exact question. And what I'd like to say is that people of African descent have contributed you know, one piece of the book is to say how extraordinary their contribution is, even though most people are never exposed to this, how extraordinary their contribution has been to the creation of this West and the creation of this modern world. Another piece of that same story, though, is how much they have suffered in the creation of these things and in their exceptional contribution to the creation of these things. And one of the worst forms of suffering for me, as I have thought about this history, both in the making of this book, but this begins in my own experience before I started the book, is what I'm going to call a kind of very unfortunate petty chauvinism that afflicts a lot of Black people about history. That you can talk about the history of Barbados if you're if you're a Bajan and you're from Barbados, and that's one thing, but you don't really feel like Ghana is part of your history, or you don't really feel like the United States is part of your history. You can be a African American and you can be, you know, very vocal in celebrating, you know, African American history, or being, you know, very outspoken about, you know, injustice toward African Americans. But it's possible to live within, it's very possible, it's too possible to live within that world without actually thinking much about how does this connect to what's happening in Barbados or in Ghana or in Britain or in Jamaica or in Brazil, right? And this is what I'm calling, and this isn't, I recognize this is not the perfect term, but I'm, for expedience, I'm just calling it a petty chauvinism. It's tempting, it's too tempting for us to each, for us in the African diaspora, to kind of live within our own selves. And I use the word selves deliberately because I think it's a prison, right? It's a prison of thinking that your story is so special that you don't really need to understand anybody else's story. And this deprives everyone of African descent in the diaspora, and it deprives, in fact, Africans themselves of the power of their story. The power of their story is in its wholeness. It's in its interconnection. It's in its complexity. It's in its mobility. It's in its persistence from one place to another of toil, of sacrifice, of suffering, of rebellion, of resistance, right? And when we allow ourselves to compartmentalize the story and to shrink it down to fit a kind of national identity, I think we are all, we meaning people, Africans and people of African descent, are doing violence to ourselves. I really believe that. And so you said, and that, I'm going to admit that that's not exactly maybe the answer you were looking for to your question. You said, why are there no commemorations? And why are commemorations? I actually have a, I've written a piece that will appear next week in the Los Angeles Times on this very question. Why are there no, why the dearth of commemoration, right? Of the history of the contribution of Africans along these, during these centuries that I'm speaking of, right? Part of the reason is I'm gonna venture is that people don't wanna remember necessarily, it's painful to talk about when we were slaves or when we were poor or when we were uneducated or when we were exploited. It's taken a long time for just to speak to the African-American experience, for African-Americans to want to talk about this stuff. So we're getting to the point now where it's kind of a moment where it's okay to talk about that stuff. But for most of American history, in terms of public discourse, African-Americans very often, and I don't want to pretend that every African-American was the same in this regard, but there was a lot of self-suppression. Not just you were not authorized by the powers that be to talk about this stuff, but you didn't necessarily feel like it was a good idea to talk about this stuff in public. Like, we don't want to remember that painful stuff. We don't want to emphasize our connections to Africa. We don't want to, you know, commemorate slavery. We want to be accepted as just, you know, like everybody else, right?
Thanks to the Center of Brooklyn History for putting this discussion up on YouTube and making it available to the world. Get the book. Howard W. French, Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War.
And before we pass the microphone in the studio over to Jazz Euphorium, we just wanted to wish all of you a happy new year and, you know, a world where there's more love, more compassion, more justice, more solidarity. So thinking of you all and hoping it's a great year for you. And we'll be back next week with some new and original Amandla material. Be well.
One love.